Listen to me, English. Get out of this organization. You're a bunch of nutcases and criminals. Intelligence work is one thing, but using hooligans to try to break up the country is another. Such fantastic dreams.
What fantastic dreams?
They think the Latvians on the verge of overthrowing their tyrannical overlords. They think the people walking in the street out there are dreaming of the moment when they can be capitalist serfs again. They think we all lie awake dreaming of going to America. They think they can distribute pamphlets and gold, and the vast monarchist army will materialize overnight. So this is what I call fantastic dream. You understand?
Yes. Sounds ambitious.
You remember the Hungarian uprising in 1956? Mm-hmm. They tried to do that here. They tried to do it under my nose. I warn you, English, we know how to deal with counter-revolutionaries. Good health.
Nestrovia.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Mental illness at Hinckley C. Could that be because the project they're working on is never going to be built? Before nuclear engineer and consultant John Large died last year, he was convinced Hinckley C was way beyond any possibility of being built. But like the Emperor's new clothes, maybe nobody has the guts to say it. Also, deeper into the Jeffrey Epstein rabbit hole tonight with a close look at the Maxwell connection and Epstein's bizarre religion with three toxic components: pseudoscience, finance, and nihilism. It turns out Epstein's transhumanist beliefs are based on eugenics, and elitists keep their true beliefs hidden because they're building on Nazi ideas of a master race. Some speculate it was spilling the beans about this elite religion that brought about Epstein's demise. Plus, YouTube closing pro-China accounts in Hong Kong. But what about Google's secret website blacklist and the former editor of Psychology Today telling the Senate Communications Committee that the tech giants working together can shift 15 million votes whichever way they want in the next year's presidential election? And Israel is at war with Iraq, only they haven't actually announced it, they're just bombing them. And it's off to Washington to hear the latest from the Israeli Justice Minister, Eilat Shaked, on their plans to expand Israel's borders and block any thoughts of a Palestinian state. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, Tuesday at noon. This week, an in-depth look at the West's elites, both from a political and spiritual point of view. We have the author of Giants of the Global Elite, Professor Peter Phillips from Sonoma University in California. He goes behind the scenes to explain who the elite are and how they hang on to power, controlling politics and the media. Then, what do they believe? Well, an extended interview with Canadian writer David Livingstone. He takes a good look at Jeffrey Epstein's creed, transhumanism, its links to the occult, and he believes eugenics and a master race. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we start this week, Martin, with some amazing news, really, about the ability of the tech giants as they're switching off the accounts of pro-China in Hong Kong and around Hong Kong to flip election results over in the United States. Now, this has been tweeted by Trump, this guy's. And it's been poo-pooed by a lot of the press, saying that you can actually persuade 15 million people to vote a different way by controlling what they see on Twitter, Facebook and Google searches and this kind of thing. Do you think that's feasible? Or is this just pie in the sky?
Well, I think there's an awful lot of people making an awful lot of money claiming to be social media influencers. I mean, look at Dominic Cummings in Number 10. I mean, he's basically a social media person. And, you know, it would be his advice that led to Boris Johnson doing a press conference without journalists there, where he just talks to camera and it just goes out on the internet. And that's the way things are going. And yes, I mean, it's quite clear that big tech companies have a very powerful position, and that if they, for example, all the people who are tweeting pro-Chinese stuff, you could argue that they're probably bots by the Chinese government, but they might just be people who are pro-Chinese because, you know, China's a big place. You've got a billion people that they might be actually, you know, genuinely putting their point of view, but they're in a position to shut them up.
But so YouTube just able to do that, actually, aren't they? They don't have to give anybody a YouTube account. They can switch it off when they. But the point here is that people are using more and more using social media of various sorts, including things like YouTube, doing Google searches, this kind of thing. But they don't necessarily realise that only a certain point of view is going to allow your account to remain open.
Yeah, I mean, basically, in a capitalist society, the people that run the means of production of information are in a position to censor it to any level that they want. And ultimately, something like the internet ought to be, to my mind, as a socialist, ought to be a public utility, like banking and railways.
Anyway, it's quite a big claim. This 15 million votes in next year's presidential election could be shifted one way or the other by these big tech giants working together. I mean, he's saying basically that's a worst-case scenario. If all of the big tech companies get together and decide they want one candidate rather than another, whoever it is, the main Republican or Democrat.
The only defence to that is if the tech companies are on different sides and they're pulling in different directions. But of course, they've got shared interests.
Well, of course
they're all big capitalists. They're all very heavily invested in Wall Street. What they're going to do is they're going to make sure that nobody challenges the fundamentals
We're at the situation now.
The economy system works.
Where a handful of people sitting in a bar in Silicon Valley can effectively decide the outcome of the election.
Well, they are going to try and influence it.
I mean, let's assume that an election is roughly 50-50 one way or the other.
Yeah, I think it becomes very, very important when you've got a very tight result. Cheating and kind of and nipping and tucking and you know, trying to suppress other people's opinions and so on, if you've got an overwhelming direction of opinion, that's not going to work.
But the way elections work in the US, Martin, it isn't really like that anymore, is it? Because candidates are very rarely put up by a party that they don't think is going to win or have a decent chance against the other person. This idea of skewing that middle ground is what many election analysts in Britain have been trying to do for years by doing focus groups and things like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the sort of things that used to be done in an amateurish way are now done in a much more professional way. And of course, secretively, yeah. But it was ever thus. I mean, if you look at the pamphlets that were circulated during the English Revolution or the French Revolution, and the American Revolution, there was just an explosion.
Have we had a revolution here?
Well, there was in the 1640s. But I mean, the point I'm saying is
that was a civil war.
It doesn't matter what we're calling it. The point is, in all of those, the American Revolution was called a revolution, the French Revolution was called a revolution. In all three cases, there was a massive increase in people circulating their opinions in those days in pamphlet form. That was the equivalent of social media for its day. And suddenly, instead of just being exposed, for example, to sort of fairly conservative opinions once a week in church, people are basically reading what we now call modern propaganda, because it wasn't really news. A lot of it was very, very biased and extremely kind of partial.
Well, what attracted me to this story was that Professor Robert Epstein, another Epstein, don't get confused, folks, a completely different guy, he is the former editor of Psychology Today in the United States, and he's a liberal, and there is Trump tweeting him. You would expect him to be really an anti-Trump type person, but he's saying basically that the election results are being skewed. Of course, the background to all of this, Martin, is that we're being told that the Russians are the big election fixers on the planet.
Well, that's right. I mean, in actual fact, you've got things like Cambridge Analytica, Bell Pottinger, who collapsed because it turned out that they were running, you know, basically, you know, they're fixing, you know, they were involved with the Gupta family, who were basically stealing from South Africa and Zuma, and they, you know, and they were also involved in creating fake Al-Qaeda videos for the CIA. So you go onto something you think it's Al-Qaeda, it's not Al-Qaeda, it's Bell Pottinger pretending to be Al-Qaeda, paid for by US taxpayers.
That's right, and they were closed down as a result of that.
Yeah, but then what happens is these people just disappear, and there's a big overlap now. You've got the Institute for Statecraft, and
they do a Sellafield, don't they? They change their name from Windscale to Sellafield.
Yeah, but also you remember the Institute for Statecraft and the other organisation, the spin-off organisation,
The Integrity Initiative,
that's right, I've forgotten that. These are basically government-run, but look as if they're private sector.
Well, government-funded.
Government-funded.
Yeah,
but there's a huge interaction between government funding and all of these kind of private sector organisations, which are basically ex-military people.
Yeah.
Psychological warfare and public relations are related fields.
What you're talking about here is the privatisation of intelligence into something called strategic communications.
Well, is the key phrase, and what that means is that governments and other organisations spend money to try and persuade people of certain things, very similar to what psychological warfare officers used to do to try and undermine the morale of their enemies, etc. And it's become, what's happened is that the techniques originally developed for warfare are being used in politics, which is supposed to be a kind of, you know, not warfare, it's supposed to be a discussion.
So,
in a way, you can't get round this. Politics has always been
Martin,
a very partisan
billions
matter.
Billions of people have sold their souls to Facebook. I'm afraid I'm one of them. Well, hopefully I haven't sold my soul to them. But, you know, what you're doing is you're telling them vast amounts of things about your social networks, etc.
Yep.
Your own personal likes, dislikes, all that sort of thing. They know really, they can get right inside your head, these Facebook people. And what we're hearing is that they might, getting back to what I was saying originally, a few of these people sitting down and deciding the outcome of the election. So let's have a listen now to this liberal from the US. Trump tweeted, and all the liberals in the US seem to be completely ignoring him or pooping. In fact, actually, no, it's the opposite. They're saying, actually, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, blah, 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 but he does. And let's have a listen to what he has to say about big tech at this. I think it was Senator Cruz, who was invited him and started questioning him on the Congress.
In 2020, if all these companies are supporting the same candidate, there are 15 million votes on the line that can be shifted without people's knowledge and without leaving a paper trail for authorities to trace.
Now, you described the Go Vote reminder, and you said it wasn't a public service announcement, but rather manipulation. Can you explain how? I'm not sure everyone followed the details of that.
Well, sure. If on Election Day in 2016, if Mark Zuckerberg, for example, had chosen to send out a Go Vote reminder, say, just to Democrats, and no one would have known if he had done this, that would have given that day an additional at least 450,000 votes to Democrats. And we know this without doubt because of Facebook's own published data, because they did an experiment that they didn't tell anyone about during the 2010 election. They published it in 2012. It had 60 million Facebook users involved. They sent out a Go Vote reminder, and they got something like 360,000 more people to get off their sofas and go vote who otherwise would have stayed home. The point is, I don't think that Mr. Zuckerberg sent out that reminder in 2016. I think he was overconfident. I think Google was overconfident. All these companies were. I don't think he sent that out without monitoring systems in place. We'll never know what these companies are doing. But the point is, in 2018, I'm sure they were more aggressive. We have lots of data to support that. And in 2020, you can bet that all of these companies are going to go all out. And the methods that they're using are invisible. They're subliminal. They're more powerful than most any effects I've ever seen in the behavioral sciences. And I've been in the behavioral sciences for almost 40 years.
So that's the former editor of Psychology Today, Professor Robert Epstein. And actually, sorry, he was speaking to the Senate Judiciary Committee there, Martin, last month. What he's basically saying is all this stuff is secret or it's hidden, and it's all under the cloak of commercial confidentiality. He has been poo-pooed by most of the mainstream press in the US, Washington Post, Huffington Post, New York Times, for example, saying, well, actually, this is all speculation. But he's pinning it down to specific reports that have been leaked and some stuff which has been released genuinely by, mainly by Facebook, but also by the other tech giants, Google, as well.
Well, they clearly have an awful lot of power, and they're not accountable for that power. And that's ultimately why, I would argue that ultimately the internet needs to be under public control and therefore under Ofcom rules, if you like. But of course, it's not under public control. It's not under Ofcom rules. And private sector people, Rupert Murdoch has got a fantastic way. Rupert Murdoch gets his way because he controls all of this media, new and old media. And Rupert generally gets what he wants.
The real genius of Murdoch was something which I suppose was borrowed from the Daily Mail, because the Daily Mail was very first started as a way of the Tory party and the rich influencing poor people. So they wanted to have a paper that middle class and poor people were going to read and enjoy, and that was going to basically diss the Labour Party or any other party that wasn't the Tory party. And the genius of Murdoch was that he didn't just buy the Times or he didn't just buy the Sun, he bought both.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's basically just seeking monopoly. And of course, it's people like him have been influencing elections for years, and the social media people are doing the same thing with a new tool. But of course, in capitalist society, there's an awful lot of propaganda to carry on believing in capitalism. The capitalists make sure that they do that because they're a tiny minority, and the majority of people haven't really got, and they don't have the interests of the majority at heart. So they have to put an awful lot of effort into bamboozling people, and they've always done it, and they still do.
So there is an article, I'll put a link up to it on our show page, which has got a link to that talk, I think, in it. I'll make sure that that's there as well. Saying big tech, and this is irishcentral.com, saying big tech, not Trump, is the real threat to US democracy. But you could also say, and not Russia either.
Well, I think that's I was on RT the other week talking about this. There's a lot of projection in these, you know, this idea that the Russians have somehow fixed elections in the West. It's laughable. What you've got is intelligence agencies and big tech fixing elections in the West and then pointing the finger at the Russians as if they're the ones who are trying to fix the elections. All the Russians are doing is watching. I mean, even if they wanted to try and influence elections, they'd be up against all these people who've already got the whole thing sewn up. So it's all pretty bizarre, isn't it?
You mentioning RT, their website has an article, Google Insider leaks docs revealing a Google search engine blacklist. Google's maintaining a blacklist for dozens of websites on one of its mobile apps, as well as a fringe ranking system that scored sites for quality. Published on Wednesday in a report by conservative transparency group Project Veritas, the documents appear to include hundreds of pages of technical details describing Google's behind-the-scenes projects, as well as internal communications between employees. The insider, Zachary Voorhees, told Project Veritas he spent over a year collecting the documents, noting they were available for any full-time employee to see, and said he feared the American election system was going to be compromised forever by Google's control of the flow of information. I saw something dark and nefarious going on with the company. I realized they were going to not only tamper with the elections, but essentially overthrow the United States.
Well, that's a pretty extreme statement. I mean, of course they're trying to influence things. I mean, the internet in the first place was supposedly, if you put a search term in, you would find the thing that most people had gone to. But of course, once they've put in all these algos in, basically you're not getting a fair, you ask a question and you're not getting the fair answer, which is what most people said about this. You're being directed and your mind is being manipulated. But of course, people who read ordinary newspapers and watch the television are having their minds manipulated. Remember the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which were going to be used in 40 minutes? And that was long before social media took on the role that it's now
okay,
taking.
Okay, so what Google's doing...
Lies and manipulation are consistent.
These documents prove that Google basically, for every website, has got a what it calls an unknown metric for quality of reliability. But that's a secret one.
Yeah.
And that will effectively send something plunging down, even if you're looking... I mean, I've tried this myself, actually, Martin. You could try it if you want at home. If you could search for my old video from a few years ago, what the BBC won't tell you about Brexit, I actually put those exact words into YouTube search, and of course they're owned by Google, and that I was getting, there were several pages, two or three pages of completely things I weren't looking for before the search term I actually looked for pops up three pages down. So there's an immense amount of power now that Google's got to bend our minds.
Yeah. And of course, however they're using that power, it's unaccountable and unacceptable. But you know, people have got to actually educate themselves. And I'm afraid, ultimately, everybody's individually responsible for trying to work out who's lying to them and why. And your good rule of thumb is to believe that they're all lying to you, and then you won't go far wrong.
Okay, let's go on to the other Epstein now. So that guy was Professor Robert Epstein at the Senate Judiciary Committee last month. But the other Epstein, Martin, much more serious. And let's start this week with something which came out last weekend, which is this interview with Virginia Roberts Giuffre. She was a girl of, I believe, 17 years old when she was photographed alongside Prince Andrew, the famous picture. She was an Epstein runaway, and I'll put the full version of this on our podcast because there's some quite dodgy details in there. So this is Virginia talking about her experience living with Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell.
It kind of worked like a pyramid scheme. Ghislaine brought me in. I brought other girls in. Those girls brought other girls in. And no matter what, Jeffrey constantly had that open revolving door of young women, young teenagers, children, I like to call them, coming through his door for one purpose and one purpose alone. And he didn't care what he had to do to get that reaction from them, to get them to have sex with him or get them to... I mean, sometimes he would just jerk off in front of them and rub his nipples. Sometimes he would have intercourse with them. Sometimes he'd make them, you know, give him blowjobs. Ghislaine participated in these acts with him as well, you know, and that was just the never-ending cycle. That was every single day. So we were at the island by ourselves, Jeffrey and me and Ghislaine, and we had gone for a nice snorkeling event. I mean, in some ways, we were a little fucked up family. I mean, we would sit together and watch Sex and the City together, and we would go hiking. We would make things together. I mean, we collected all this pirate treasure, like just broken glass bottles, and we make a table from it. Like, we did weird family stuff. All right, so it just wasn't all about that, but that was how this worked, the inner goings of it. You know, it was, all right, you need to have sex at least, you know, Jeffrey needs to have sex at least 7 times a day and have this happen at least, you know, this many times a day. But in the meantime, you know, we're going to sit back and have some popcorn while you're giving him a blowjob and watching Sex in the City. Like, it was just really screwed up, kind of a little family unit for a while. So anyways, one day we went snorkeling on Jeffrey's island, and it was beautiful. It was a great day. I was exhausted. It was, you know, hard swim in the water. And we get up and we're taking off our flippers on the jetty. And Ghislaine, you know, starts talking to me about how would I feel about having a child. What? Having a baby? Yeah, it would be your baby, but it would really be our baby. And we would have you sign a document that says that you would have an allowance. We would pay you $200,000 a month, and you would have a nice house. But this child is really ours, and we can do what we want to do with our child. You could basically never take this child from us. I said, okay. Let me, you know, get my massage certificate, and I really want that. That's important to me, because eventually when you guys are done with me, I would like to have something to do with my life. Okay, we'll work on that, and blah, blah, blah. So a few months later, he sent me to Thailand to go get a massage certificate, right, on top of picking up another girl for him, of course. I escaped. I call Jeffrey to let him know that I was not coming back and I was not bringing the little Thai girl back. And he said, you know what? Have a nice life, and hung up the phone.
Well, shocking stuff, isn't it? I mean, we're getting more and more information about how this operation worked. Nothing, it doesn't shock me or surprise me. As I said earlier in the first hour, this is all related to blackmail of important people. It's not just, depraved behaviour for the sake of it.
But that doesn't actually square with what she's saying there about them wanting Virginia to have children for them and to sign a certificate saying that you will look after these children, we'll pay you $200,000 a month to look after them, but they won't be your children, they'll be ours, and we can do what we want.
Well, in other words, as they grow up, they will be inculcated into the slave reality of the cult in which they've been born. That's what that implies, isn't it?
So, I mean, in a way, one does wonder if Virginia herself might have been in danger by speaking out about this.
Well, I'm quite sure lots of people who've spoken out about these things have ended up dead. It's quite clear. I mean, as I say, this is not just to do with wealthy people having bad attitudes towards children and women. The whole purpose of this is what intelligence services have been using for years as a means of blackmailing powerful people.
But there's wheels within wheels, aren't there? So that you reckon that's at the core. But there are other things which are also used as cover stories. Anyway, let's have a listen now to someone you mentioned last week. It's Whitney Webb, Martin. And here she is talking about some of the, I suppose, deeper Epstein network and looking into the UK. And also something called the Promise software scandal. Do you know anything about that? The Promise software scandal. Apparently Epstein was deeply involved in all that and many people who were connected with him.
Well, Promise was, I think it was developed by the CIA as a means of trying to predict terrorist attacks, because they said, well, if people start, moving money around, like the put options on 9/11 on the airlines, then that's an indication that there's going to be a terrorist attack. And I believe that's why, and I think there was some general talking about we should employ people to look into this as a means of predicting terrorism. But of course, it did predict a terrorist attack. There were put options on the airlines, but the put options ultimately led back to Buzzy Krongard, who was deputy director of the CIA. So predicting terrorism is quite easy if you're the ones who are doing it.
Promise, apparently, you can look it up under the INSLAW. INSLAW scandal, a Washington DC based information technology company that marketed case management software for corporate and government user, developed Promise, an early case management software. So yes, I guess you're right. There's an article, Octopus and the Promise Software Scandal. So the idea is they're trying to predict, or somehow predict, when people are going to do terrorist attacks before they actually do them. Is this real? Is it able,
well, I mean,
are people able
that's,
to do
that's
that?
Only one level. In actual fact, what they want is to get a load of money so that they can then use it in there is dirty scams.
But I mean,
schemes.
Can we turn this on its head? Is it possible for us sitting in a studio here to predict what the global elite might do as a possible terrorist attack?
Well, I mean, there are obviously clues in the way stock markets operate about what goes on. I mean, I mentioned the put options on the airlines on 9/11. Clearly somebody had inside knowledge and somebody made a load of money. But when it was looked into by, I've forgotten the name of the guy now, the former FBI investigator.
John O'Neill?
Mike
Rupert?
Mike Rupert, that it led back to inside the US security structure. Now, if you are CIA Mossad and you are going to carry out a 9/11, then you can use it as a means of making money because you take a put option on...
What I'm getting to with this Promise software here is that you can sell a form of software which will predict something that you yourself are going to do, and then you'll say, oh, look, we predicted it.
Exactly. So, in other words, the idea that they want to use the stock market to try and predict terrorist attacks is a blind.
It's a very...
In actual fact, they're the ones doing the terrorist attacks, so it's just another way for them to make money, just as the people who own the Twin Towers insured them against terrorist attack just as they bought them 6 weeks earlier and then made a fortune. Larry Silverstein got 14 million, or was it billion quid, dollars in insurance payout.
Anyway, fascinating that the Epstein scandal goes right into all of this stuff. Also, Martin, you mentioned people who have been suicided or had mysterious deaths connected, and Whitney Webb talks about that too now.
I talked about the OSS. It's believed that Donald Barr originally hired Jeffrey Epstein to work in the Dalton School, and Donald Barr had previously worked at the OSS. After that, he was hired to work at Bear Stearns. Alan Greenberg was a close friend of Roy Cohn, and was the honorary chairman of a dinner for him that was honoring Roy Cohn, I believe, in 1983. And the other honorary chairmen were other close friends of Roy Cohn, including Rupert Murdoch and Donald Trump. After he left Bear Stearns in 1981, he, according to journalist Vicki Ward, was a financial bounty hunter of sorts, looking to chase down money for governments and powerful people. The Evening Standard of England later reported that during that time, Epstein claimed that he was working for the CIA. Vicki Ward later said that one of his clients during that time was Adnan Khashoggi, who was known to be working for the Mossad. He was also working for the CIA, and he was a major player in this Iran-Contra scandal. Then in 1987, he meets up with Leslie Wexner, who has connections to this Meyer-Lansky crime syndicate, as I point out in part three. He also meets up with Steve Hoffenberg, who he allegedly met through John Mitchell, who is the former attorney general to Richard Nixon. And Mitchell was actually cited as a friend by Craig Spence, a disgraced Washington lobbyist who was also running a sexual blackmail operation with children that was discovered in the late 80s. And Craig Spence, in some similarity to Jeffrey Epstein, was found dead under somewhat mysterious circumstances, and his death was ruled a suicide. And that takes us up to 1991, which right after that, that's the same year that Robert Maxwell died, as well as several other people that were connected to the Promise Software scandal, not just Maxwell, that includes Senator Towers, also died that year, as did journalist Danny Casolaro, who was investigating that scandal. And soon after Robert Maxwell died, his daughter, Ghislaine Maxwell, moved to New York and began her relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. And as I point out in part three of my series, Robert Maxwell was known to be an operative for the Mossad and did several favors for Israel over the course of his career, and was also using the Daily Mirror Group, some of the funding for that to fund Mossad operations in Europe. So the intelligence links, I think, are very clear, and that's just the early history. We're not even getting in to the 90s yet, and I'm going to be delving more into those connections in part four of my series, which I hope to be out in a few days.
That's Whitney Webb there, and she's a writer for Mint Press News. She's based down in Chile. Her latest article, as she talks about there, Martin, is out now. It's called From Spook Air to the Lolita Express, the Genesis and Evolution of the Jeffrey Epstein-Bill Clinton Relationship. So this is, I suppose, why so many people are focusing on Epstein, and I'm not going to let this go away, is because he was very, very close to so many powerful people. And she mentions just a few there. She's talking about, you know, in just a few minutes, going through several decades, the links to Iran-Contra, this guy Leslie Wexner, who's the financier of these high street sex shops like Victoria's Secret, things like that, and also to this guy Meyer-Lansky, you've mentioned on this show quite a few times, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, the linkages between the mob, Meyer-Lansky, the intelligence services, OSS, CIA, in the US, and Mossad are you know, these organizations have been working together for years and years and years on things like bringing drugs into the US to fund Iran, to fund the Contras in Nicaragua, which killed 30,000 civilians. These people are gangsters, and
what she's describing there is really the highest level people involved in things like drug smuggling, political machinations, trying to, you know, get massive government contracts to con people out of vast sums of money, and also these high level links to the mob. Now, anyone that's listened to this show over the years will know that we have identified pretty certainly the various people involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy back in 1963, the US president, down to the David Attlee Phillips, CIA officer, and he was the commander of the operation, and his people working for him were Chicago mobsters, weren't they? They were hitmen for the Chicago mob, a guy called James Files, Johnny Roselli, and Charles Nicoletti. And James Files is still alive. The only reason he's still alive is because most of the others have died or whatever, but or been killed. But he was trained by the 82nd Airborne Division, and when there were attempts to assassinate James Files, he shot back, and he made sure that he wasn't going to be assassinated. He ended up in jail. Some fascinating stuff with James Files afterwards. But this is the mob effectively being involved with the CIA, killing the president and then taking over the country, Martin.
Absolutely. And this is the real world, folks. And it's not about, sovereignty and you know, the things that people think it's about. This is the real world. This is how it really works.
Also involved in a lot of this is Ghislaine Maxwell. We heard particularly Virginia Roberts talking about her there, but obviously it was surprising that she hasn't been arrested and charged with child sex trafficking. She was quite clearly involved very, very heavily in what Epstein was up to. She's the daughter of Robert Maxwell. And let's have a listen now to the former British MP George Galloway, because he was very, very much involved back in the 1980s with the whole scandal around the disappearance, one could say, or death of Robert Maxwell. Before we hear from Galloway, Martin, what do you make of what happened to Maxwell? I think he fell off the back of a ship, didn't he, and disappeared.
Well, the conspiracy theory, if you like, is that he didn't just fall off the ship, that he was pushed because he knew too much and he needed to be got rid of.
So was he killed and given a new life?
The suspicion is that he was killed, yeah.
And given a new life or not?
Well, maybe given a new life or maybe not, but the point is the story doesn't add up.
The thing is, the it's similar to the Epstein thing, isn't it? Suddenly someone very, very, very powerful, involved with these intelligence services, etc., suddenly disappears.
Well, dead men tell no tales.
Okay, well, let's let George Galloway tell his side of the story. By the way, he's been taken off FM. He was on Talk Radio, I believe, or LBC, one of these radio channels in London, based in London. But he's now got his own, I think it's internet only, but anyhow, that is called The Mother of All Talk Shows. And here he is speaking on the most recent one about his knowledge and connection with the whole Robert Maxwell disappearance story.
In the 1980s, I was working for the satirical magazine in London called Private Eye. Robert Maxwell may well have been our public enemy number one. We regarded him as a fat fraud, fraudulent, a forgery, his whole life a forgery. And we were not afraid to say so. In one celebrated legal action taken by Maxwell against our magazine, our founder and editor, Richard Ingrams, went to prison rather than name me as the source of the story complained of. I never forgave Maxwell for that or for many other things. Late one Saturday night, the celebrated American author Seymour Hersh, the man who brought us the massacre of My Lai, the story behind the massacre of American war crimes in Vietnam, caused to be delivered to my London address a file of papers. It was a chapter in a book that he intended to publish, but in a very unusual move, Robert Maxwell's lawyers had forbidden to be printed, distributed, or sold, a pre-publication injunction, which meant that it was impossible for this celebrated American author to have his story read here in Britain. But the papers were interesting enough to me that on the Monday, I went into Parliament and concisely summarized the principal charges against Robert Maxwell from Seymour Hersh's book. They were, inter alia, that Maxwell was a Mossad agent, that Maxwell was the greatest thief in Britain in the 20th century and had stolen £500 million of his own employees' pension funds, that Maxwell had betrayed the whereabouts in London of the brave Israeli Jewish whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu, who came to London and foolishly turned up at Robert Maxwell's newspapers with the secrets of Israel's hundreds of nuclear weapons maintained at Dimona in the Negev desert. This story was subsequently published courageously by Andrew Neil at the Sunday Times, again, of which more later. But his whereabouts, now known to Maxwell, were leaked, according to my motion in the British Parliament, to the Mossad, who honey-trapped Vanunu with a blonde woman in Leicester Square called Cindy, and he woke up drugged, gagged, and bound in the hold of an aircraft bound for Israel. When he got off that aircraft, his jaws were wired together like Hannibal Lecter, so that he couldn't impart any more truths to the world about Israel's illegal and secret nuclear arsenal.
Well, interesting there, Martin, that the courts, I mean, there's lots and lots to talk about there, but that the courts found against Richard Ingrams and Private Eye, and actually what they were doing was just refusing to name their source. And actually, it certainly looks now as if what George Galloway was saying about Maxwell was true.
Well, yes.
So if you print something that's true, you can still go to jail for it if you're a publisher, a printer, or maybe a broadcaster.
Well, look at Julian Assange, who's rotting in Belmarsh prison as we speak, for exposing the criminality of the US government and the British government.
No, but the great tradition of Julian Assange still carries on, Martin. There's very, very brave people out there like Bellingcat doing his job.
Well, Bellingcat, as we all know, is basically a front for the NATO intelligence services. He's got no intelligence background whatsoever. They've picked him up as some kind of amateur sleuth who's an expert on everything, and they just feed him the line and he comes out with it.
So what do you make of Ghislaine Maxwell and her role in all of this? Clearly, she's been procuring young girls. Why hasn't she been arrested? Why isn't she being charged he was for child sex trafficking?
Well, you can imagine that these people have been running this stuff for years and they've got loads and loads of dirt on everybody involved. And that makes it very difficult to move against them because the people who have got the dirt on them don't want it to come out. And so, you know, this is how they protect themselves.
Well, I'll have a little bit of an answer as well for that question in our next clip from the interview, which is going out on Dialect on Tuesday, the full interview. And this is with David Livingstone. He's the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. He's based in Canada. And here he explains, amongst other things, that when Epstein got told that he wasn't going to be prosecuted a few years ago, he got basically slapped wrists, and the guy that let him off, who was a senior politician, I think he's now a Labour secretary, and he resigned when Epstein was arrested this most recent time. He was saying he was just told, well, Epstein is hands off. You know, the justice system can do nothing to somebody like that. So it does rather go back to what we were saying originally about the royal family, is that there is an elite and they really are above the law. That's certainly the case for Epstein in the States, as we're about to hear. But Martin, this is a rather serious situation, isn't it? We're told that everyone's equal under the law, but actually the law is only for the poor people and those without the power to say, well, actually, I've got to get out of jail free card. This is something from the Monopoly game, which is quite real, it seems.
Well, the only thing I'd say about that is the big weakness of this criminal elite is that they are actually criminals. And that means that they are, we're not talking about voting them out, we're talking about sending them to prison for crimes. And ultimately, that's what will have to happen. It's what Imposimato was trying to do in Italy. It was the head of the Supreme Court there. And ultimately, there is going to be a rule of law, and that's what the demands are going to be.
So we're talking about get-out-of-jail-free cards here, but actually, in Epstein's case, he played his get-out-of-jail-free card, and the next time that his collar was felt, he didn't have any get-out-of-jail-card left.
Well, that's right. And, of course, because of the information revolution we were talking about earlier in the hour, it's very difficult. You know, things that they've got away with for years suddenly come back to bite them in the bum years later.
Is that potentially a political shift under Trump, do you think?
I think what it is that the knowledge of things like the JFK assassination, anybody who doubts that it was carried out from inside the state just needs to look at the voluminous evidence which they can access on their phone. In the past, when you argued with people about stuff like this, you'd have all the information, but they didn't have the information. Very hard to get people to read all the information, and therefore very difficult to catch the people who are doing it.
I mean, the ultimate...
Whereas now,
the
of course,
ultimate,
it's all there for those who've got the time and the inclination. You can find out anything you want
before
about
we hear from
things.
David Livingstone, the ultimate question really, Martin, is why now with the Epstein arrest and suicide?
Well, why now is a very good question. I think it's to do with the fact that we're probably moving towards a financial collapse and a war, and you know, various things, various loose ends are being tidied up.
So what you seem to be implying is that some people within the state, within the system, know this is happening and they're trying to expose people who are involved.
Well, there may be I'd like to think that some people involved within the police, intelligence services and military are aware of the things that we're aware of, and they're trying to do something to deal with it. I often ask the question, what would you do if you were an honest cop in Nazi Germany? And it's a very difficult question to answer.
Anyway,
what should you do?
Let's now hear from the Canadian author David Livingston, where he talks here about this whole transhumanism. What is this belief that Epstein had and many of the people surrounding him, about the master race, about eugenics, and the main three parts of transhumanism he talks about here, which are pseudoscience, finance, and nihilism.
It's just a new name for the same old thing. It's because it's the same old thing that has been adapted to modern science, which is why it now has a new name. It's the same old interest that's modified in ways that it couldn't have before because of what's available to modern science. I think it's important to look at Epstein in context as well, too. It seems pretty evident to me that he was probably a spy working for the Mossad and the blackmail operation for Mossad. He's admitted himself that he worked for intelligence. And what's his name, Acosta, the judge that gave him his walk-away deal, he said himself recently that he wasn't able to touch Epstein because he was told that he was hand-off because he was apparently an intelligence asset. So you look at the bigger picture and you look at, his connections are so deep, it's almost mind-boggling. The people in this black book included John Kerry, Kissinger, Steve Forbes, Richard Branson, celebrities like Dustin Hoffman, Ralph Fiennes, Peter Curry, George Papadopoulos, Stephanopoulos, sorry. and the list goes on and on and on and on. Like, so many deep connections. So you've got to wonder what kind of world is he operating in. So that world basically also boarded into a number of scientists, so people like Richard Dawkins and Stephen Hawking, and Marvin Minsky. These are all the people who, many of them were invited to his island for various discussions. So if you look at the pattern of Epstein's life, there's really three paths there that are parallel, and I think it's very much indicative of the sort of culture that these guys come from. So, first you can start with physics. So his first interest was in physics. Secondly, he ended up in finance. And then thirdly, his extracurricular activities, when I say sexual activities. So I do, those are not to be interpreted as being independent. They're all part of some kind. We can only speculate of what he's really coming from, but if understanding the occult as an outside person, from what I've seen from my investigation, those are three paths that are commonly associated. So, the physics is basically often verges into an area of pseudoscience, as like alchemy has always been, and magic is basically always been a kind of pseudoscience. And then, finance, of course, is a way for them to maintain, achieve wealth, sustain a degree of authority and power. And then ultimately, they are often Luciferians or they are nihilists. And that nihilism or Gnosticism is expressed in a kind of libertinism, which regards, like Freud said, basically that, sex is our basic drive and instinct.
So that's David Livingston, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. But Martin, he's really saying there that there's a lot of beliefs that elite people have, amongst which is obviously trying to gain more and more power, and techniques they have for that, which they do everything they can to keep as hidden as possible. Epstein wasn't really doing that.
Well, I mean, some of it's hidden. Some of it's hidden in plain sight. I mean, loads of billionaires and top people are big fans of Ayn Rand, the novelist, who basically just preached what she called objectivism, which was essentially personal selfishness, that people should just be personally selfish, and that being wealthy and powerful was good, and that nobody should try and help anybody else because that was a bad idea, and that caused them all the problems in the world.
Well, he talks
an astonishing amount of wealthy people who actually believe that that is a philosophy. He's got no real basis with the real history of philosophy. It's just made up.
Is it social?
Very, very convenient for those who've got power.
Nowadays, is social Darwinism.
Well, social Darwinism was invented by Herbert Spencer in the 19th century. And, of course, social Darwinism was actually imposing upon Darwin's scientific theory a load of social ideas, as if the survival of the fittest implies that it's great that there should be some wealthy people and lots of poor people. Nothing in the actual theory of evolution says any such thing. It was an imposition of an ideology of supremacy.
Could it explain why we're seeing a shift away from public spending and caring for people and looking after those, for example, disabled people? I mean, this actually does line up to a certain extent. Martin, this does line up to a certain extent with all the Nazi ideas about basically killing off disabled people at birth.
Well, I mean, what was it? Gordon Gekko said, "Greed is good." Powerful people want to have their power, they want to have their money, and they are prepared to sacrifice the generality, and especially the weak and the powerless, to their goals. 'Twas ever thus. If you read the history of the Roman Empire, you'll see exactly that. If you read the history of the British Empire, you'll see that. If you look at the way we're living now, it's exactly the same thing.
I mean, do you seriously draw parallels between the elite and people surrounding Epstein and the Roman Empire?
Well, can't you see it? It looks very similar to the sort of things that used to go on in the emperor's court. It's all in Suetonius. Human nature doesn't change that much. Powerful people are psychopathic. That's pretty clear. If you read your history books, that's pretty clear.
Well, I imagine there are actually different sorts of opinions amongst powerful people, and those who are going to prevail are likely to be the most psychopathic ones, potentially.
Well, that's why psychopathy remains in the gene pool.
If there is no more rule of law, which goes back to what we were saying earlier. Anyway, where do you think why do you think it's just final round off? Why do you think Ghislaine Maxwell hasn't been arrested, since she clearly was involved in child sex trafficking?
Well, I understand she's been seen in public reading a book about the CIA. CIA agents.
Well, there are some doubts over this photo as to how recent it is, and it also looks as if there may be some subliminal messages deliberately put out in that photograph.
Yes, indeed. So, in other words, the psychological warfare people are playing games. Ghislaine Maxwell is probably a Mossad agent, and therefore she's being protected, just like the five dancing Israelis on 9/11 who photographed the first plane crashing into the building, were subsequently arrested and then released, even though they clearly had foreknowledge of the attack. Ghislaine is being protected. That's why.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. This means that the rights you currently have will be protected after the UK leaves the EU. The scheme is fully open, and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Before we go on to talk about final roundup, we're about Hinckley C, Martin, what's been happening there with the mental health of the workers, we have... what do you make of all these links with Epstein and the Mossad and the Israeli state?
Well, I mean, he's basically probably a Mossad agent, which means obviously he's cooperating with the CIA, and they've got a vested interest in getting Western elites to support Israeli policy. So they get them nice young girls, they get them compromised, and then when they come into positions of power, they're going to do things like recognise Jerusalem, which is an Israeli policy, because they've got all the dirty pictures of them doing naughty things with underage girls.
Anyway, let's go over to the US now, where recently the Israeli Justice Minister, Eilat Shaked, spoke at the Jerusalem Post Forum. Don't really see anything of her on the mainstream press here in the UK. Anyway, here she is talking about Trump's moves towards Israel and foreign policy in Israel, but also Area C, which is a part of one of the districts of Israel, which is rife with these Israeli settlements, which many believe are illegal.
First, I want to say that I really appreciate President Trump's effort to make the Middle East safer and better. He made three strategic steps that we all should thank him for that. One is withdrawing from Iran deal. The second is moving the embassy to Jerusalem. And the third is, of course, recognizing the Golan Heights as a territory of Israel. And just for that, I want to take this opportunity to say thank you, President. Area C, 60% of Judea and Samaria, almost 500,000 Israelis, around 100,000 Palestinians. When we are talking to apply the Israeli law, we are talking only on Area C. Area A and B can be a confederation with Jordan in the future, with Gaza. You need to remember that in Jordan there are more than 50% Palestinians. So I know that right now it sounds not realistic because King Abdullah doesn't want and there are other constraints, but we need to set the goals, and we need to set the goals according to what is good for Israel. And it's not good for Israel to have a Palestinian state in the heart of Israel.
Well, I mean, they're obviously very well pleased with what they've achieved by suborning the US government to their goals. Ultimately, they are essentially aggressive goals, which are going to lead ultimately to war and
I mean, how does this relate to all the anti-Semitism in the Labour Party we were talking about earlier, or doesn't
it? Well, it doesn't relate to it, except that the charge of anti-Semitism is related to anybody who criticises the state of Israel's policies or the existence of the state of Israel, and that's but if you don't accept the state of Israel, you're an anti-Semite. Now that's rubbish. There was plenty of anti-Semitism before the state of Israel existed, and the state of Israel is a political entity.
But actually, and Martin, some people the reality whether it should just exist a minute, or not. Martin. The that's reality another. Is that Palestine belongs exclusively to Jews, including Gaza and the West Bank, and Jerusalem must be restored as Israel's final capital, exclusively for Jews.
Well, that's right, and that is actually a fascist ideology. That's what it is.
And are you, I mean, surely that's an anti-Semitic statement in itself.
No, it's not. The Jabotinskyites in the right wing in Israel modelled themselves on Mussolini's black shirts. Okay. Don't forget, the black shirts were not anti-Semitic, they were just fascist. Okay. So the right wing in Israel are fascist. It's actually quite clear what they are.
Okay, so anyway, we have to do Hinckley C next week. Time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, the Brexit Party's prospective parliamentary candidate for Bath, Jimmy Oganoussi, and Labour Councillor for Ashley, Mike Davis. This show's podcast and our contact details are at thisweekoneword.org.uk, and links from this story I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM bank holiday weekend. Great to be back. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.